You're listening to Beggar's Banquet, a podcast that explores the intersection of food and music. We interview bands and artists to discuss a relationship with food, both on and off the road. My name is Lucas Samuels. Growing up with musicians as parents, it's no real wonder that Ariel Posen would take to an instrument. Hailing from Winnipeg, a city infamous for its brutal winters and a history of strong musical exports, the Guess Who, Bachman Turner Overdrive, Crash Test Dummies, the Weaker Thans, it's really the perfect place to hibernate and attempt to master something. In Ariel's case, that something was the electric guitar. Since 2013, Ariel has been quietly building a name for himself, touring and recording with the brothers Landreth, coloring their bluesy roots rock and roll with his signature slide guitar sound. But Ariel's voice and playing are just as well suited for the spotlight. In 2019, he released his debut solo record, How Long, earning him love from the press and comparisons to John Mayer, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and Bruce Springsteen. Despite the state of the world, 2021 is looking like a breakout year for Ariel. He recently released his second album, Headway, and the hype is proving to be much deserved. Headway is one of those genre-blending albums, effortlessly mixing pop, blues, R&B, and roots rock. It truly has something for everyone. With its incredibly catchy choruses and masterful guitar playing, this is an album that keeps you coming back for more. Today on Beggar's Banquet, we're talking with Ariel about what it's like growing up in a musical household, the changing food scene in Winnipeg, and his approach to writing songs and playing guitar. Welcome to Beggar's Banquet. Let's dig in. Ariel, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It's my pleasure, my friend. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Can you tell me about your earliest food memories growing up in Winnipeg?
Well, I grew up with my parents who are pescatarian, they'll eat some salmon, but never meat. They're just not meat eaters. I learned later that I was a big carnivore. However, I've been a vegetarian since New Year's. but I remember growing up really having a love for salad. Caesar salad, Greek salad, just lettuce. I think we were just given so many vegetables and salads specifically. You know, all the kid things like pizza was great and all that other stuff. But what sticks in my mind, and to this day, I still have such an affinity for salad. I think it comes from that early upbringing.
Yeah, that's not one that we get a lot here.
I had my KD and Alpha Getty and all that easy to prep kid stuff too, but that one is the one that stuck, you know.
Who was doing the cooking for you and your siblings growing up?
My parents, both of them. You know, they've always eaten well. They wanted to bring us up on healthy eating as well. So we didn't, you know, we had to fight for, you know how it is when you're, how old are you?
I'm 32.
Okay. So we're very close in age, you know, growing up, going to friends' houses and, oh, well this, my friend here is like, they're, what's it called? The pantry. They've got Dunkaroos and fruit roll-ups and this is like, how come we don't have any of that stuff, guys? We just have veggies and like maybe some crackers. So the grass is always greener, you know. We were always, well, I'm grateful for it now, but I remember always just, I couldn't wait to go over. I always pushed to go to friends' houses instead because of the snack selection.
Yeah, I feel like everyone else's kitchen always had better snacks than your own at home.
Totally.
And was yours the kind of family that was doing like Friday night Shabbat dinners and stuff every week, or what was that like in your house?
Actually, yeah, we'd go to my grandparents and do those dinners, which were fantastic. That's actually where I started eating meat. My grandparents are carnivores too, so I kind of got a taste for it through them. And I was honestly the only one in my family that took a liking to it. The rest of my family, I mean, they'll once in a blue moon, you know, hey, we'll have some chicken. Once in a blue moon, we'll have this. But like really almost never, I immediately took this liking to it. And I was like, Yep. This is what I like. I wasn't necessarily like, I need meat to survive. It was just something that I gravitated to. I really, really just enjoyed the taste of it and the idea of it, I guess, other than like eating animals. Like, I have a very different perspective these days, but at the time I just found it really delicious and I wanted to eat that. And again, just like how I was saying, you go to your friend's house and their pantry, snack pantry, so much better. It's like when I left my house, went out to a restaurant or went, you know, my grandparents or someone else's house and, oh, we're having steak. Oh, we're having turkey or like anything like that. I was just like, oh my God, this is something I've been missing out on my whole life. This is pretty amazing. Yeah.
And why'd you decide to go vegetarian?
To be honest, my wife and I have been toying with the idea. She's been on and off with meat. I feel like she's been eating a lot less meat much longer than I have. I've always eaten meat since, you know, I was young, and doing a lot of traveling and touring, it kind of serves as comfort food, at least for me, when you're in airports or if you're on the road traveling, you kind of want to stock up on something that's going to keep you full and satisfied. And I always just thought that, you know, I can't just get a salad. I'm still going to be hungry. I don't just want to eat pasta or something like that. That's just going to be kind of more empty carbs to fill me up with. I want to go for that protein. And I'm a huge animal lover. I'm very sensitive towards animals and animal brutality. So like, I've always felt like such a hypocrite eating meat. Even though, you know, a lot of animals also eat animals. It's just something that was always kind of bugging me. I have a lot of friends that have gone vegan recently and have just, no one's pushed me to do it, but have told me a lot of just good things about it and like all the advantages and how much benefit there is and how much, you know, if it's done right, there isn't much of a difference. Now, I'm going to say quickly, I'm not vegan. I'll eat cheese and whatnot. And you know what? I did have fish the other day. So I'm like, I'm kind of my own pescatarian combination right now that I'm still trying to figure out, to be honest.
It's a journey, but for sure.
It's a journey. And I spent a lot of time, you know, in California, in places where that culture of eating is so much bigger. So certain places, like, you know, Winnipeg, it's not a very vegetarian friendly place in terms of restaurants and stuff. So much of it is, yeah, you have to prep it at home. But a lot of my friends down there introduced me to some great spots, some great places to go eat. And just the idea of it is very appealing. The things I noticed is how much I felt better. So other than like the ethical, you know, hey, I just don't want to eat animals anymore. With the exception of salmon. Sorry about that. That was cool and all, but I actually did. I've noticed, you know, technically I'm on month 3 here. I have noticed just feeling better without it. I haven't missed it. The idea of it, I miss the idea of having a burger, the idea of having a steak or having some chicken or whatever it is, you know, but I haven't been actually craving it. I don't know how far I'm going to take it. But for now, it seems to be working, and it's great. So yeah, it was a little bit of influence from some friends. We watched a bunch of documentaries that really kind of made me turn my head.
Yeah, there's so many of those Netflix.
There's so many of those, right? And I had been putting those off. I didn't want to be that guy who watches a documentary and goes, okay, I'm changing my ways, and I do it for a week, and then I fall back into it. You know, one thing about this pandemic right now is that it's given us the chance to just be in one place for so long. So it was just a lot easier. And that's a big reason why I think I've managed to keep this up so long, is that I haven't been traveling. I haven't been in those situations where I just need something quick and easy. Yeah, I'll just get the burger and fries. Yeah. Just give me put some chicken in it or whatever, you know, that feeling. So
yeah,
I feel like that's a huge reason why it's been so easy, but I'm pretty dedicated to maintaining it and keeping it up.
No surprise that life of a touring musician is not always the healthiest lifestyle in terms of food.
It's tough. It is really tough. as you probably know, just when you're going on tours, wake up, eat something shitty at the hotel or wherever you're staying, drive for 8 hours. Could we sneak in some quick food before the sound check or setup? Yeah, generally it's going to be something crappy because you're trying to save money and you don't have time to just to do like a proper sit down unless you make a plan to leave really early in the morning. So you've slotted sit down lunch or dinner time, which I've done before too, and does make a difference. And then you play a show and then you're exhausted and you don't have the energy to find good food. But more so importantly, the show is done and the only stuff that's open is pizza, fast food.
Yeah, and you're coming off the endorphin rush, right?
Yeah.
It's a good time to put back a ton of beers. Also a bad time.
Yeah, it's both. Yeah.
So as a vegetarian going back to Winnipeg, can you still go to like Bernstein's or is that off the table now?
I guess I could. A place like Bernstein's has a lot. To be honest, Bernstein's, one of the sons is like one of my best friends in the world. And oddly enough, that's not one of the places I've frequented in my years of living here. There's a bunch of other places that I used to go so much more of the time. And to be honest, when I'd go to somewhere like Bernstein's, that's more of a breakfasty spot, at least for me. And I'm not a huge breakfast guy. I know it's the most important meal of the day, but I like brunch. I like, I'm not going to go get bacon, eggs, toast. I'd prefer to get something closer to the lunch region.
Yeah.
If they can. And I just found like there's other places, not that they don't do that well, they do. And it's like one of the most beloved places in town. Don't get me wrong.
Shout out to Bernstein's.
Shout out to Bernstein's, big time. But yeah, I always found myself kind of going to other spots in town. Are you familiar with a bunch of other Winnipeg?
Yeah. You spots? Hit the falafel place, Seeing Amy.
Yeah. Classic falafel place. I mean, Winnipeg has Stella's, which has turned into a revolutionary source of brunch, dinner, breakfast, any kind of those. That I feel like that kind of exploded. There's the Tallest Poppy, which is fantastic. That's a place in Wolseley where you can get a really good breakfast lunch combination. There's a lot of places.
How do you think the food scene has changed in Winnipeg from when you were growing up to now?
That's interesting because I honestly don't really remember paying attention to it when I was a kid. I really started paying attention to it in my teens when, you know, I was old enough to go out with friends in grade 9 or 10 and, hey, let's just go to Perkins at 2 in the morning. Why? I don't know. Let's just go. You know, that kind of thing. I go to shitty places. And once I started, I guess just like shortly after that time is when you start dating and you start being aware of what restaurants are good. You want to go with friends to get breakfast when you're hungover from the night before. You have all those kind of spots. I feel like so many of the hot spots in Canada, like falafel place, Bernstein's, for example, they've been around for so long. They've been around since I can remember. It's like the Stella's and some of these other places that have started and have blown up. There's a place called Clementine in Winnipeg that I want to say they've been around maybe 5 years now. And, you know, each time you go there, it's the ultimate fancy breakfast spot too. You'll be waiting. You'll be waiting outside or you'll be waiting inside. Usually like, but you're gonna have to wait an hour for a table. It's one of the
for an hour and hope it lives up to the hype.
Yeah, and it does. It's really, really, really good. Like restaurants do, they come and go. Some stick around forever and then some make it just a couple years. I know how tough of a business it is.
Especially
now. It's torture because I live in Montreal now and we all know how good the food scene is there, but you can't go anywhere. So, I mean, even on Uber Eats, you can get some good stuff, but that experience is holy to go into restaurants. And
I mean, taking out from Beauties is not going to be the same as sitting down there.
Exactly. Never will be. Yeah, soon enough, hopefully. Soon enough,
yeah. So your parents are both musicians.
Yes.
What was it like growing up in a musical household?
Honestly, it's all I know. I mean, I remember I've only remember this because I was told about it, but like when I was a month and a half or 2 months old, I was already on a flight just going to one of their shows with them, accompanying them. And my childhood was very much like I had day jobs. They would all, my dad worked at the CBC for almost 30 years. My mom was a teacher. But on weekends, they were the ultimate kind of touring stay-at-home parents because they were always around. If they went out of town for shows, it would be on the weekends, come leave Friday, come back Sunday. And then in the summers, we would go as a family to play all the festival circuits. So we would get to experience that and make just a family trip out of it. And I was just used to going to parties and or events. And it's like my parents were the band or my parents were playing it. And people would be like, oh, they sound great. And it's like, yeah, of course they're playing. It was just so what I was used to. It was just all I knew. So, it was a very big influence for me because even subconsciously, I always had music in me and I was interested in music. I was interested in instruments and songs and playing and singing. And it was never something for me to do it and take interest to it. It was never forced. It was very natural. Even when we were signed up for piano, before I started playing guitar, I was just like, yeah, this is just what you're supposed to do. This is, my mom plays piano. I'm going to play piano. And then I realized, oh, I see. I don't have to play piano. I can play this other instrument that all my friends are playing and that is I'm hearing and all the music I'm listening to, which is the guitar. And they were very supportive. Let me do that.
What did you think of a Finjan and klezmer music in general?
I loved it. I grew up, again, I can't stress enough that it's all I knew. When you grow up with something and you see that, that's your idea of what music was. So at a very young age, it's like I wasn't really listening to music in a focused way until I was maybe 6 or 7, I'd say. So those first few years, yeah, my parents played music, and that was the music I knew. We'd go hang out at the studio when they recorded their records, and it's just what it was. So I loved it. And then you start taking it for granted because you're just used to it. So you don't, I'd stop respecting it, but it was just, I was immune to it. It was very special, and it was always cool to see people at shows like blow up and love it and react positively to it. Because like the musicianship in that band was insane, insane. And as a kid, it's just like, yeah, this is fun. I love it. I just don't, yeah.
What were you guys listening to in the house? Were you like listening to klezmer music exclusively or were your parents?
No. We were not at all. We were brought up on the Beatles. And so like my mom grew up listening to like James Taylor, Carole King, stuff like that. So there, and the Beatles, of course. So there was a big influx of that type of stuff. My dad loves everything. He grew up playing in blues bands and stuff like that, but he ran a show called After Hours here in on the CBC for almost 30 years. So he's a big jazz guy too. So we had a lot of jazz playing around the house. So it was just like this eclectic mix of music. And all that stuff played heavily into my own, my psyche. The thing about music too is that, and my dad working at the CBC is that as a 7 or 8 year old, normally take your kids to work day or, in service or something like that. And you don't have school that day. You're too young to stay home alone and you got to go to work with your parents. I was so lucky that my dad would just go to the library. Just do whatever you want. And the library at the CBC is every single album out at the moment and previous all on CD. You grab a set of headphones and I would take bundles of CDs like this. I know no one else can see this, but I'd spend all days listening to albums, reading the liner notes, looking at the lyrics, looking at who played on stuff, even if I didn't know who the musicians were, all my favorite records. Cause in those days, music was, you watch it on Much Music or you go to like an HMV or something like that and you have to pay $15 for a record to just have all these albums for free in my hand. I could just listen to them all, open them, look at them. It's just a pretty crazy experience.
Yeah, especially at a young age. Like, those are such formative years, and then you're just soaking in all this different music. It's like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah, 100%. Those were formative years. So I had a huge, huge, huge impact on me in every way of being a musician and just being a music fan, music lover, you know?
And were you listening to the CBC at home? Like, were you listening to your dad on the radio?
Well, he was just a producer, so he wasn't on air ever. Okay. I don't necessarily recall us listening to the show. We definitely had it on often because he wants to, you know, you want to hear. It's like checking mixes, or like when you're working on a record, if your song plays on the radio, you want to hear it. We did tune into the show often, but we also just always had CBC on. Like, I, every morning that I can recall at my parents, from childhood to when I was a teenager, wake up every morning, CBC Radio 1's playing in the kitchen, talk radio, you know, and then in the car driving us to school, always radio, always CBC. It just grew. And even, you know, going to CBC as a child all the time. Oh, hey. Like, you know, you just know everybody there, and you're just kind of so used to that life and that scene. It's another thing. It's not that I took it for granted. It's just, that was just what was normal. It's just so strange.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's cool when your dad has a cool job. And what age did guitar come into the picture?
It came into the picture around seven-ish. So I started on piano, like I said, and, you know, it was the time where, first of all, the Beatles anthology came out, which was gigantic. I was very floored by it. And our parents kind of made us watch it. They're like, this is what we grew up on. You need to learn everything about the Beatles and listen to it because you're going to love it. And sure enough, we did. Along with the Beatles anthology, this was the prime time of Dookie. You know, Green Day, Nirvana, Chili Peppers, Soundgarden, Rage Against the Machine, Everclear. I could go on and on. It was the mid-90s was that time of rock bands being alive.
Yeah.
Guitar and well. Rock.
Yeah.
Guitar rock. Yeah. Guitar as an ensemble. And yeah, all my friends started playing guitar. And so I was like, yeah, hell yeah, I want to do that too. So I switched.
And how did Slide come into the picture?
Well, Slide came later. I mean, when I started playing gigs when I was 14, like making money, very little money, but making money when I was 14. By the time I was 18 and graduated high school, I was basically just playing gigs all the time. I went to university for about a couple months, realized I made a mistake, dropped out, fully jumped into playing in bands and just playing as a hired gun. So people would go, hey, got an artist that we need you to play for if you want. Oh, yes, I'll do it. Can you play on this person's record? Yes. Can you go on this tour? Yes. I was saying yes to everything. And, you know, if you want to be a sideman, if you want to be a musician that can get work, you gotta be versatile. You gotta be that Swiss Army knife. So keep a capo nearby, keep a slide nearby, keep whatever other tools you think you might need on the gig to cover a sound or a style. And it's not that I took a liking specifically to Slide. I enjoyed it. And then I'd find myself on sessions or on gigs, having to learn other people's slide parts. And I do recall some of those people being like, hey, that was really great when you played the slide thing on that song. Why don't you do it on some other songs? And I was like, yeah, okay, sure. Didn't think much of it, but it felt natural, I guess. And I spent a lot of time with it. It's not like it was just the first time I picked up a slide. It was great. It wasn't. I sat with it for a long time, got to know it. And then I just stumbled upon slide players. You know, I saw Derek Trucks, and started listening to Bonnie Raitt, like Cooter, Jerry Douglas, even Dobro, and some pedal steel players, and some great Canadian slide players as well. And it just finally just, wow, this is speaking to me in a whole other way. And I, you know, I took a guitar, tuned it to open E and took it on every gig, tried to just learn how to navigate through a new tuning like that. And I just made it a part of me. I spent so much time with it. I had to get to know it. And the only way to get to know something for me is like to apply it and do it as much as possible. So on the gig, off the gig, just work it into your subconscious.
Yeah. I mean, you're definitely defining your own sound with it. I think when I put on that record and I was listening to Headway, I'm like, oh yeah, this doesn't sound like anyone else playing slide. Like I could hear some of the influences, but you've definitely crafted your own voice with it. It's super cool.
Thanks, man.
And so were your parents supportive when you told them you wanted to be a professional musician and dropped out of university?
Yeah, 100%. In fact, when I told them I wanted to go to university, they thought I was joking because I never really cared in high school. I never just cared. I was so not present. I played a lot of basketball. Like I was very serious about playing basketball. So my life was basketball and music in high school. I was playing in bands, but I was like the captain of the team. And I spent a lot of time playing. I was never, you know, going to make it onto a university or college team or anything like that, but I was very dedicated and I spent a lot of time and I was playing music every other second that I wasn't doing that and didn't give a shit about school. Did the basic minimum, you know, this class. Yeah. I'll just literally get it done. Whatever. Like I was kind of not present, which in some ways I do regret, but I've also turned out okay. It hasn't affected me too badly.
It also sounds like you might have the world's coolest parents.
I do have very, very cool parents. They basically said, listen, man, you know, they know a lot of musicians, a lot of friends with a lot of musicians. They've seen them end up in divorce. They end up seeing them in like kind of down and out situations. It's a tough living. It's a really tough go. And they said, if you really want to make it happen for yourself, no one else is going to do it for you. You have to really make it happen for yourself. You have to hustle. You have to make opportunity happen. You can't wait for the phone to ring. You just got to hustle, essentially. So that really stuck with me. And they could see how passionate I was about music too. They would never say, no, you really shouldn't do that. It was just, for sure, that's so great that you want to do that. But just remember that, like, you know, and they said all that other stuff, but fully supportive, yeah.
I want to talk about the new album just a little bit because Headway has so many great melodies. Like, I think it's a really great showcase for songs that just get stuck in your head. Coming back, Nobody Else, Heart by Heart. Was writing super sticky songs, was that intentional for you?
I think I'm always, I like that way of describing it, by the way. I think we're all trying to write sticky songs and you can only hope that they're as sticky as possible. I mean, my first record, I had 8 songs and I recorded 7 of them and was able to kind of put together 10 tracks. For this record, I had more time and I was just more comfortable with the idea of being an artist, and I had just spent so much time touring, playing some of these songs, just getting to know this side of me, essentially. So I had 20 songs instead of 8 songs, and so when you have a bigger catalog of songs, chances are you're going to have a bigger chance to pick the best ones out of that. So I picked 12 out of the 20. Not that the other 8 were bad. They just weren't as strong as the ones that were picked. And you can just only hope that, they're catchy, that people like them. So much about making a song sticky. And I'm going to keep using that because that's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's attention to the lyrical themes and the melodies, of course, but also just the production and the arrangement and just the little subconscious candy bits that you wouldn't actually listen for or notice, but they kind of just fall into your brain without you even realizing it. And I'd say that's kind of the stuff that we spend the most time on while making a record like Headway, is just having everything with purpose, not just doing anything to do it, doing it because it'll hopefully have some kind of impact.
Right. That's like the Rick Rubin production approach, right? Like only what's essential to the song, strip everything else away.
Yeah. It's got to just serve the song. Less is more. Generally, if you have a lot of things going on, it doesn't give enough space or breathing room to the things that deserve to be focused on. And, you know, there are times where more is more, and it can be a vibe thing, and it has its place, but as a general template, yeah, we go for that. It's all about that. Yeah. Dynamics, building. It's got to just, songs tell a story lyrically, but the arrangement of a song has to tell a story as well. We're constantly stair-stepping, growing towards something. That's what makes, you know, listening to a song like an experience. Like, you know, when you watch a movie and it's like, okay, act one, introduction to the characters, introduction to the plot. Act two, a little bit of conflict or something like that. And then act three, the finale. It all comes together, or it doesn't, but it's the big climax of some kind. You kind of want to treat your... I try to, like, not only do I treat a song like that, I treat a solo like that. I treat each section like its own story arc as well.
So with a song like Angeline, I know you like to stretch that one out when you play it live. I mean, I could see you doing that with a song like What Are We Doing Here? That one seems like it'd be ripe for jamming out. But are these songs on the album ones that, you know, you plan on kind of expanding on and changing on the road when touring is a thing again?
Yeah. So I mean, Heart by Heart, Nobody Else, It's You, I'm Gone, and I'll Be Finding You. Those songs I had actually been playing. I wrote some of those songs kind of right after How Long was finished. So I had been sitting on those songs for quite a while. So I was able to play them live a number of, like, quite a while. And yeah, I mean, I'm Gone has a stretched out solo on the record. So live, we were doing that outro solo and just kind of keeping that open. Heart by Heart, we would kind of do a fake, spoiler alert, we do like a fake ending and then bring it back for like an outro solo. Little things like that. That's the thing that hurts the most about not touring, is you come up with these alternate arrangements that just keep the song fresh, not only for a listener who's listened to the record, but for yourself, the one who has to play it every single night the same way. Those little things really make an impact for yourself. But I try not to do it too much, because if you make too many moments like that, like the Angeline one is the biggest one. If you have a few Angelines in a set, it really dilutes the experience of what Angeline has to offer, let's say. So I try not to stretch anything too much compared to that one. I just don't want it to, that being said, some nights if you're feeling it and if it's a good night, it just happens. That's the beauty of improvisation and like not planning, having a set time for something like that. But
go where the music takes you.
Go where the music takes you. But yeah, I just always mindful of, you know, only, it's hard to say. Like I think of an album and a live show as two different experiences. Album, I like to have it more song based. You know, there's a lot of guitar. It's not guitar music. Certainly not. But guitar is the focal sonic tool, of course. But, you know, come to a show, you're going to see a lot more guitar playing. We're still going to play those songs. We're going to do all the singing, the background vocals, the arrangements. But yeah, we'll stretch out more. We'll play. But it's still all about the songs live. So I'm just always mindful of, like, just a few moments. Too much of anything is always not great, in my opinion. So always just finding that perfect balance, yeah, of a couple tunes like that.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I don't think of Headway as a guitar album necessarily either, but, you know, it's cool, you know, live to show people you got chops.
Hey, I mean, I'd be lying if I said that most people come to the shows because they know I'm a guitar player. Like people come because they're guitar fans and they've seen me play, or they've associate me with something guitar related, and I'm fine with that. That's all good with me. And, you know, yeah, you'll get elements of that on the record, but I'll really let that shine a bit more live, because that's also my upbringing. Like, as a musician playing, you know, I cut my teeth as when I was young, playing three sets a night every night with my own band, with other bands, stretching out from 9 to 2 a.m. every night of the week.
Putting the 10,000 hours in.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you've toured internationally. any restaurants or meals that really stand out for you, and what cities do you look forward to stopping in when touring comes back?
Oh man, I feel bad because I don't remember all the names. I had a moment where I tried to write everything down. You know, it started with coffee shops. Wherever I'd go, I'd say, yeah, this coffee shop, like Vita in Manhattan is like one of my favorite places. Or, you know, anytime you can find a Blue Bottle is great. Some of my favorites, I mean, let me think here for a second. There's a breakfast place in Brighton in the UK. Again, I forget what it's called, but we went there. We got to do a UK tour right before the pandemic and a Swedish tour, which I'm very grateful that we got those in. And me and my guys, we were in Brighton. So it was February 2020. We were also on tour in Brighton, January, February 2019 as well. And that first time we found that restaurant, and it was so amazing that not only did we try to, I mean, it just worked out this way, but I think our hotel was close both times to this restaurant. I'm so sorry, I don't remember the name, but they did this like unbelievable kind of avocado toast with hash browns, and they had this like vegetarian, I wasn't a vegetarian at the time, but like this kind of, not, it wasn't quite minestrone, but like this heavy thick vegetable soup that was so good, and the coffee was very good.
Not your traditional greasy fry up then.
It was classy though, but it wasn't like a diner. It was very rustic, and you'd walk in and you'd think it was more of a high end place, but it was like a step up from a diner, not quite like five star quality, but like really, really, really good. There's a great place in Highland Park in LA called Amara Kitchen, which I was recently introduced to, and it's actually a vegan place and unbelievable. Again, great positive atmosphere and just a lot of grain kind of bowls and fantastic. I went back. I had to take my wife there. She loved it. I've had a lot of different, it's funny because who you travel with and tour with, everyone kind of eats differently. So like I toured for a long time with a good friend of mine, shout out to Rhino Voth. He loved wings. So he was the only guy that loved wings, and I kind of loved wings too, like yeah. Not as much as him, but
so you're hunting them out.
We would always go hunt the bat. And I remember one time in Buffalo, New York, we were staying in some suburb. It was a very shady area of town, and we looked up this place, maybe a 15-minute walk from the hotel. It honestly looked like a Legion, but like a rundown Legion. It was horrible, and the wings were absolutely amazing. It's almost those kind of experiences that are my favorite with eating, especially on the road, where you just discover something.
Yeah. What do you like to keep with you in the van in terms of van snacks when you're touring?
It's easy to get carried away with horrible junk food. It's different if you're driving or if you're just chilling. If I'm driving, I actually like to gets like spit seeds or something like that. It's a very, I don't mean cheap as in financially, it's a cheap way to just like feel like you're eating constantly. And it's like almost like a boredom thing. And obviously when you're tired, it's a movement and a repetitive action that kind of keeps you awake.
Yeah. And then you learn how to deshell them in your mouth when you eat enough sunflower.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, you get a bag. The trick is you always, whatever flavor you get, that's all personal preference, whatever size bag, all good. You got it. Whenever you're at the convenience store, or the En Route, or the whatever, like the Lovies, whatever the hell you're at, when you buy it, you got to go to the coffee machines and grab the largest size cup and just take one of those with you. And that's your spit cup. I have a friend I toured with. We went from like Ottawa all the way to the East Coast for a run, and he would just put them in his mouth, spit them on the floor of his van, and his whole van, this is his own personal van, but the floor was just full of spit seeds. kind of gross, but kind of hilarious at the same time. You know, snacks in the van, what's important for me is to always have water, especially for a long drive. I like to always have coffee. Coffee is like a comfort to me if I'm working, if I'm out for a walk, if I'm driving, if I'm sound checking. I literally kind of always feel comfort having a coffee with me. It's not that I have like a caffeine headache or anything like that. I just, it's a taste thing and it's a comfort thing. Other than that, just little things that you can kind of peck at. I like fruit, but I find that fruit in a van, it's one thing if you're on a bus, like everything's in a fridge and you can kind of keep things contained, but in a van specifically, I try to avoid fruit and stuff like that, because the longer something like fruit sits around, the worse of an experience it is for everybody. It just starts to stink a bit. So just like kind of neutral smelling food, stuff that won't perish as fast, is usually pretty essential. It's a fight, man. You know, it's, you want to feel good, you want to eat healthy, but oftentimes you're just hungry, you're bored as fuck, and you want what's easiest. And generally you're going to go, just get the Doritos. That's Mars bar.
Doritos, not a neutral food, not a neutral smelling food by any means.
It's true. Yeah. It's easier in the UK, honestly. A lot of the gas stations have really decent, and in Ireland too, and in Europe, to be honest, it's a lot easier to tour and travel. First of all, the drives are a lot shorter. Like, first of all, in Canada, we drive so much, more than anyone else, more than anywhere else for major
uninteresting driving.
Yeah, it's insane. But over in the UK and Europe, gas stations will have like really decent sandwiches. Some of them will have sushi, and I sushi is my favorite food. Like, I will do grocery store sushi pre-made any day, and I love it almost as much as freshly made sushi. It's just makes me very happy, and I feel okay eating it. You know, I'd rather eat that than a sandwich that's been sitting around all day.
Guilt.
Yeah, exactly. But I was on tour in Sweden, and we'd stop at these gas stations, and the guys I was with, who were all Swedish, would, this sandwich is really good. Like, they would swear by these sandwiches and these buns and these little things. And I got into it. I started trying it. It was just like, this actually is really high quality compared to what, like, you would never touch a sandwich at a 7-Eleven or
Couldn't pay me.
Yeah, me neither. So it's a kind of just a different thing there.
We're going to get into some rapid fire questions. So I just want your off the cuff responses. All right.
Ooh. Okay.
Okay. Meyer's Deli or Bernstein's Deli?
Definitely Bernstein's, but I will say Meyer's at the beginning of pandemic, they were doing a little bit of a delivery service, and they live close to where we were staying. So we were doing heavy delivery orders of like roast beef, turkey. So it was fantastic. I'd love to say both, but I got to go with Bernstein's.
Best coffee shop in Winnipeg.
I got to go with Little Sister Coffee Maker.
Goodwill Social Club or King's Head? Which would you rather perform at?
Well, I grew up watching music, basically shaping myself as a musician, watching all the King's Men on Sunday nights at the King's Head, and then just playing eventually in all the King's Men a lot and playing my own shows. So I have a very strong connection to the King's Head because it has been around way longer than the Goodwill. But the Goodwill has become such a fantastic venue and supportive for artists in the last 5 or 6 years. And every time I've played a show there, it's been such a great experience, and gone to a show. So I love them both, but I got to go with King's Head. I don't know why I have to justify my answer every time, but it's how I am.
Favorite venue to see a concert can be anywhere in the world.
It's a tie between Hotel Cafe in Los Angeles or Rockwood Music Hall. And both those venues are like, it's to me, they're like the same venue. And they Rockwood has Rockwood 1, Rockwood 2, Rockwood 3. It's a small, have you been to either?
Yeah, okay. I've been to Rockwood. Yeah.
Okay. So hotel cafe is the exact same thing. You've got the small stage, stage two, and then like the big area, stage one. I've played all the stages at all these places. I've attended shows at both places. And, you know, you can go see a show at an arena or a huge, cool venue, a theater. That's all great, but there's something about more of an intimate venue where the people that go there are in that music circle, are musicians, are music lovers. And the vibe of going into a room like that, whether you're on stage or off stage, the appreciation, the attention to the music, it's a push and pull experience. So the whoever's on stage is really feeding off such love from the crowd, and the crowd feeds off that love that they're giving, and they get it back from the artist in such a different way from an intimate room like that, that you just don't get from the bigger rooms. And I love playing a bigger room. Don't get me wrong. Playing to like a 500 cap room feels really good, but there's something just magical about that intimacy.
Most memorable show you've played to date?
Well, most memorable just because, you know, it was close to before everything shut down. I was playing in London at a place called Omira, which is a very cool, like 300 cap room. It was a sellout, and it was just like the energy in there. It was kind of like that hotel cafe Rockwood, intimate but jam-packed kind of vibe. And people were singing along, people were rowdy but attentive. And it was just kind of one of those magical experiences where you just can't explain it. If you were there, you understood it. And if you weren't, it just looked like a great, fun, packed show. And had I known that a month from when that show happened, that we, to this day, still wouldn't be playing shows, I fully appreciated it and loved it. But now I'm so grateful that I got to do it right before everything shut down. And just that trip, we had a couple of days in London, and I had a couple of friends that were in town at that same time. I got to go to a friend of mine that played on Headway. He was in town with his band that he was playing in. So I got to go to his surprise birthday party, got to see another friend. It was just one of those magical, worked out nicely. And to top it all off, we had this amazing show. Yeah.
Slide guitar player that's influenced you the most?
That would be a guy named Kevin Bright from Toronto.
Favorite Canadian band of all time?
You know what? I think I got to go with, all time is tough to say because there's been a lot more iconic and bigger bands. But for me, I love the band I Mother Earth.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite that's a name.
That was the first, actually funny story if you want to hear it. That was the first rock show like in an arena I ever went to. And I was in grade 5. I was already playing guitar, and I guess through my dad's connections, he got us backstage. And so we watched this show. It was I Mother Earth and Moist, take you back to the 97 there. And we went backstage, and sure enough, I'm meeting Edwin, I'm meeting Jag, Christian, Bruce, who was the bass player at the time. I'm just like, oh, what is going on here? And there's a guy from 92 City FM, which was the rock radio station. It still is actually around here in Winnipeg. Hey, little buddy, what are you doing back here? I don't know. I'm just here with my dad. Hey, why don't you call me tomorrow and we'll get you on the radio. Okay. And sure enough, we called him to the radio the next day. And, you know, I'm a shy, like 10-year-old kid. So did you have fun at the concert?
Yeah.
Did you, what was it like meeting I Mother Earth? And the guys,
good.
Do you think you're going to go to more shows and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Like I was so terrified, right? But it was so cool at the same time. And I remember going to school the next morning, being so nervous and embarrassed that everyone probably heard it. And I was going to show up at school and be like, you were on the radio? You were on 92 City FM? What a loser. Where in reality, literally the coolest thing you could do ever. And I showed up to school and no one even heard it, so it didn't matter. But yeah, that's my Canadian band pick.
Nice.
And that's that's a very memorable concert for sure.
I think they played some shows last year, I Mother Earth.
They did. They had been doing a bunch of reunion tours. And actually, you know what? Funny enough, I lived in Ireland for a couple of years in the past few years. And right before we moved, you know, Facebook and all this stuff brings people together. Like, everyone's available now in a way that they weren't. And I saw that Jag, the guitar player from My Mother Earth, is on Facebook. And you know what? I just wrote him. I said, listen, I never do this kind of thing either. But I said, listen, man, I just want to let you know, at the time, this was 20 years ago or so, I just want to let you know, I was, you know, I was at your show in Winnipeg in 97. I was backstage with my dad. I was just a kid. And you took the time to talk to me and make me feel like I was so important to be there, you and all the guys. And I just wanted to say that has stuck with me and had an impact on me till now. Like, I never forgot that. Like, thank you so much. And yeah. And then he wrote back, like, oh man, that's amazing. Thanks for that. And then we got chatting, and then we just like, oh, you're moving to Ireland. I have a bunch of family in Ireland. And like, then we just started down this whole rabbit hole of stuff, but it was just like, ah, love that.
Yeah. That's super cool. Very humble. Yeah. That's a good segue into my next question. Who do you think that is the most slept on guitar player on the scene right now?
There's so many. I mean, we live in this time now where, you know, you could kind of be an Instagram guitar sensation in 2 minutes if you do it the right way. I think there's a lot of guitar players being slept on. But the truth is that guitar music isn't what's blowing up, so to speak. It's the guitarists that maybe have the songs are the ones that are getting the recognition.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of us. I say us because just guitar player as well, but a lot of us that no one's chasing specific notoriety, but you want to feel like you have purpose and have that respect and just feel like the work you've been putting into it is somewhat paying off to some degree. That's a really tough question. I could probably give you a list of 50 people that I feel like are being slept on.
Fair enough. You want to shout out one? we can circle back to it. It's all good. I have two more questions for you. Desert Island album. What would you take with you?
Oh, so tough. So tough. If I had to pick one, I will go with Abbey Road. Abbey Road gives me the satisfaction of obviously great songs, satisfaction with tasty guitar parts, satisfaction with tasty vocal arrangements, and just an eclectic mix of songs. They're not just all the same kind of thing. There's a lot of variety. There are so many other albums I would want to be listening to, but if I had to stick to one, I'm going to stand by that.
You get that musical suite at the end. Love a suite.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's an experience.
Last meal on earth. What would it be?
Oh, I've thought about this a lot. I think I would probably do sushi. It's truly my favorite thing. However, if it's your last meal on earth, what would be important to me is going crazy on dessert. If you're not thinking there's repercussions because you're already going, right? Like, I would literally do like an 8-pack or 16-pack. I probably wouldn't get through even a quarter of these, but as big of a box possible of, I'm just trying to think of where I would get them, but yeah, of donuts. I'm trying to think of a great shop that, like, obviously not Tim Hortons or Robbins or anything like that, although I love them, but like a really good local donut shop.
Tim Hortons, you can put back like 100 Timbits and call it a day.
True. It's not quite the same as a full nut.
Well said. Ariel, tell the listeners what you got going on in your life.
My album Headway came out March 5th. And I would love if you gave it a listen on Spotify or Apple Music or wherever you like to stream or steal music. You can check it out on Bandcamp. You can buy a vinyl or a CD at my website, arielposen.com. And I'm doing a live stream album release concert called the Headway World Tour on March 25th. So I would love for you to join us. Tickets are $10. It's going to be really awesome. We're going to play down the entire record and then some. And I'd love to see you there.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you taking the time.
Pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into our conversation with Ariel Posen. If you dug today's episode, please subscribe to the pod, rate us 5 stars, and leave a review. You can also visit us online at beggarsbanquetpod.com and follow us on social at beggarsbanquetpod. My name is Lucas Samuels. Thanks for listening.